Wars have been fought in Christian history about what actually happens to the bread and the wine or the juice. MCC says that's God's job. We are not going to argue about it. So if you hear anyone making claims about what specifically happens to the bread and the cup, that is not indigenous MCC theology. That is imported from elsewhere. But that is kind of important to know about these stories. The first one I recall is probably about 20 years or so ago. I was a layperson, a lay leader, and I was fortunate enough to be involved in a committee of laypersons who now I have no recollection of what we were particularly meeting about, and no cracks about my age. But we as a committee had the great privilege of going to one of our newer MCCs at the time, and that was MCC in Monterrey, Mexico. It was a new and a growing and a lovely and exciting young church. And I had the privilege of being the communion celebrant the Sunday that we were there for our committee meeting. And I had celebrated communion scores of times, so I was not unfamiliar with what to do at the table. At the end of consecrating, at the end of distribution, as we do here and in most places, the person at the table, the celebrant, will consume some portion of the leftover host, the wafer, as well as drinking the remaining juice or wine. On this particular occasion, when I took that remaining piece of wafer in my mouth, it was the perfect size and shape that it immediately adhered to my palate. Like a suction cup. And I was at the verge of gagging in front of this congregation. And while I was struggling with this inner battle of what was happening in my mouth, I had the narrative in my mind, I cannot be the gay, white, unordained layperson choking on the body of Christ in front of this congregation. Pardon?
As if you were straight.
Oh, yes, of course. If I was straight, it wouldn't have been a problem. Yeah, whatever. Thankfully, and I cannot remember, it was purely by the grace of God, somehow it came unattached from my palate and continued. And thankfully, no one quite knew what had happened. But afterwards, a couple of people came up and said, "You had a very odd look on your face at the communion table." And I was like, "Yes, I'm sure I did. It was good practice for pastor face." Yeah, yes. There's a cocktail named after that now, by the way. The other incident I recall was a few years later. I was a newly ordained MCC clergy person, and my first official clergy position, I was a volunteer associate pastor at a small MCC in Glendale, which is right adjacent to Los Angeles. Very small congregation, about 20 or 25 folks at that time, for a few months before I assumed my first full-time pastorate in Berkeley. And once again, I was at the communion table. Now, I was a fully vested, fully ordained clergy person, not that that made any difference in whether I knew what to do or not. But at the end of having served communion, funny how this happens at the end of things, after I had been consecrated, after it had been distributed, and I was at the table, and I do not recall quite how it happened, but in my gesturing, I hit the communion chalice. Now, it didn't just tip over. It flew off the table, rattled down the marble stairs, and rolled up the tiled aisle in this small church, Episcopal church, in which this congregation was meeting. I was mortified, and depending upon who the person was, they were either grinning in amusement or in silent horror about the communion chalice bouncing and spilling the whole way down the aisle. Needless to say, I quickly hastened into the sacristy, which was much more convenient than ours, grabbed a few towels and purificators, we tidied up and carried on. But it was one of the most mortifying events that had ever happened when I was at the communion table. And by the way, Corey, this is what I was warning you. Just saying. So in many cases, when something unexpected happens during worship, there may be discomfort. Sometimes there may be amusement. But when things go awry in our sacred spaces, it is not always casually received. Some of you may recall in the 1980s, there are AIDS activists who demonstrated during Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City because of the silence and inaction of the Roman Catholic Church at that time, responding to HIV and AIDS. And I remember in the 1990s when I was in Los Angeles, the group Queer Nation and its activists infiltrated one of the many anti-gay megachurches in Southern California in that day. They substituted decoy bulletins that looked just like the church bulletins, but had alternative messages in them, we'll simply say. And they had scheduled different individuals would stand up at different moments during that worship service and disrupt the worship service. And as you can imagine, in both of those situations, they were not well received. They were expelled and, in some cases, arrested. When the propriety of our sacred spaces and our established orders of worship are violated, it is not only disruptive, it can be downright dangerous, just like the story we hear today about Jesus in the Jerusalem temple 2,000 years ago. Now, if you're familiar with the stories of Jesus, you will know this story. And for many of us who are familiar with it, but perhaps even more so for those who are unfamiliar with this story, this may be a surprising, even a puzzling story about Jesus, because many of us hold a treasured image of Jesus as a kind and loving teacher who healed the sick, taught about loving our neighbors, kept company with the excluded and the marginalized, which he did, all of those things. We may also sometimes recall that he called out the abuses that were perpetrated by the powerful, and he verbally shredded his opponents among the religious self-righteous of his day. But even still in our imaginations, I think we like to keep him forever peaceful and nonviolent. Yet all four of the Gospels in the Bible preserve this dramatic incident, distinctly uncomfortable and unpeaceful portrayal of Jesus, where he apparently destroys property and becomes, or threatens to become, physically violent. This is not our gentle Jesus, meek and mild, of popular piety. This is the fierce and outraged Jesus of the Gospels. Not only does Jesus overturn the tables in this story overturns many of our preconceptions about Jesus. This story, as I mentioned, is found in all four of our Gospels, which is itself noteworthy, we should recall, because while Matthew, Mark, and Luke share a great deal of material in common, John actually shares very little with the other three. So we do well when we take special note of stories that they all share in common as being particularly important. And while some of the details of the story differ between the versions, for example, John, this is the second chapter of John, so John places this incident at the very beginning of the ministry of Jesus. The other three place it at the beginning of his final week before his arrest and crucifixion. But they all recount the very same story. During Passover, Jesus goes to Jerusalem. He enters the temple. And while he is there, he drives out the merchants and money changers, overturning their tables. And John includes this detail. He makes and uses a makeshift whip. It is an unsettling, a frightening incident. What was the big deal? What is this display of, we might call it, so-called righteous anger? Had Jesus become unhinged because of the stress he was under? What prompted that kind of action? And in short, we need to recognize it had everything to do with where he did it and when he did it. This was no random outburst. This was no sudden emotional reaction. In fact, many, if not most, I'm getting ahead of myself. Many, if not most, scholars of the New Testament believe that this was planned. Jesus had thought it through in advance. This was what we would call a direct action, a protest demonstration at the seat of power in his world. That's the where and that's the when. The Jerusalem temple was well known in the ancient world for its great beauty. It was an attraction as a sacred space not only for Jewish pilgrims, but it was an ancient tourist attraction. It was a destination for travelers from all over the ancient world and the ancient Near East. The temple was constructed in concentric circles, from the holiest of holies that was entered only once a year by the high priest, to the court of men, to the court of women, to the court of Gentiles. It was enormous, beautiful, very well ordered and bounded. And the largest court was the court of the Gentiles, because so many non-Jews would come to the temple to admire its beauty and to pray, even if Judaism was not their tradition. And if you happened to go to the temple as a Jewish pilgrim for a religious observance, many of which were prescribed across one's lifespan, there were very detailed sacrifices that you needed to give for certain things. And if you were traveling as a pilgrim from any distance, you were not going to be bringing your own lamb or your own pigeons or doves, because you weren't going to try to take care of them on the trip. So when you arrived at the temple, you would purchase your sacrifice that was demanded. And because travelers came from all over the ancient Near East, different countries and ethnicities, there were a variety of currencies that needed to be converted for that transaction to take place in the local currency. Sounds like a currency exchange. When you travel internationally, we all do that. So what probably began as a thoughtful convenience and a practical measure, on-site currency exchange and vendors, over time, it had become a financial racket, ever-increasing administrative fees, cronyism. The temple priests would grant friends and families the premier locations, no doubt sometimes for a fee. We imagine a temple as a place for worship only, which it was a place of worship, and temples are places of worship, as are churches. But in the first century at the time of Jesus, the Jerusalem temple was the largest and wealthiest financial institution in ancient Palestine. And we also have to recall that in the ancient world, there was no so-called separation of church, temple, church and state, one of the healthiest innovations of the modern world, I will say from the pulpit, the separation of church and state. The political was religious. Kings and queens were gods or goddesses, but if they were not gods or goddesses themselves, they ruled by divine right and appointment. And in the specific context of Palestine under Roman occupation in Jesus' day, in order to secure some autonomy as an occupied people, the Jewish religious leaders, including the priests in the temple, had negotiated a cooperation, an agreement with the Romans. Even the high priest was subject to being authorized by Rome. And while the priests and the temple personnel were not as loathed as the tax collectors for Rome, but by the poor and the peasant class, the temple priests and administration and hierarchy were viewed with great distrust as collaborators with the enemy occupiers. The political was religious, and the religious was economic. That's a lot of background, because we need to know, when Jesus walked in to the Jerusalem temple, he was stepping into the place where all of these powers resided. And when he did that during Passover, when the number of persons in Jerusalem and in the temple were exponentially greater, and it was a feast of liberation from oppressors, there was always the looming threat of an uprising. So when Jesus walked into the Jerusalem temple at Passover, the where and the what, he was stepping into a powder keg. And when he overturned the tables and the money changers, he lit the match. This story is most often called the cleansing of the temple, but it is more rightly called the symbolic destruction of the temple, which, if you reread the version in John, it makes it very clear. If you destroy this temple, it will rise in 3 days. A symbolic destruction of the temple. This was a powerful, visible demonstration. Street theater, we might call it. Political action street theater. And it unveiled the toxic corruption. It demonstrated a prophetic judgment that the destruction of this system was imminent. We see you, we see what's wrong, and this will collapse. I wonder if that sounds like anything in our modern world. Confronting the powers is dangerous. It can even be deadly. And that is why many scholars agree that if there was any incident that elevated Jesus from being an annoyance to being a threat that needed to be eliminated, if there was anything that got Jesus killed, it was likely this incident at the temple. So a lot of then and there, and the where and the when. But what about here and now? So what? Our world is so very different in so many ways, isn't it? Politics, religion, economics are not quite as wedded as they were in Jesus' day. I think this stands as a reading that still speaks to us today because of that well-known saying of Reinhold Niebuhr that Chuck so often likes to repeat to us. The gospel comforts the disturbed and disturbs the comfortable. This is a story that comforts the disturbed, but more than anything, disturbs the comfortable. Because as much as we might like, we cannot keep a comfortable 2,000-year difference between that incident in the temple and our own lives, because it is bound to overturn some of our assumptions and practices. So as I reflected on that, there were three things that I think this overturns. Long introduction, short three-point sermon. There you go. Three things that I believe that this story still overturns for us today. First, it overturns the assumption that what happens in our sacred spaces stays in our sacred spaces. What happens here is supposed to stay here. This is some private sanctuary from the trials and the troubles of the world, which it may be when we are troubled. But we need to always remember the spiritual is political. While I and we should ardently, ardently defend the separation of church and state, we must equally recognize that when we observe an injustice that is contrary to our values as followers of Jesus Christ, we must speak up and say so that as a Christian, I object to that policy, to that practice. And we should not be shy to say so. You know, MCC has never been silent when the humanity or equal rights of LGBTQ people has been under threat or in question. We have always acted and spoken publicly because of our faith to defend and to promote the rights of LGBTQ people. But does it just stop with ours and us? What about immigrants that are under threat? What about gun violence, an epidemic in our country? What about global warming, the actual body of God and our fellow creatures under threat because of human practice and political policy? I am aware that there are those at MCC Portland who have been made uncomfortable by comments that I make from the pulpit and have made since the election of Donald Trump, if not long before that. And I know of at least a couple of folks who have left because of that. And I recognize that as a risk. But I also recognize that the founder of Metropolitan Community Churches, Troy Perry, was fired by the board of directors of MCC Los Angeles because of his public fasting and protests. It's part of MCC's DNA to speak out publicly because of our spiritual values. So what happens here doesn't just stay here. So the second thing that I believe this story overturns is embedded in that pithy comment that John relates to us. Don't make God's house a marketplace. Don't make God's house a marketplace. No, wait, what? That has nothing to do with us. We don't sell sacrifices. We don't sell indulgences. And this surely cannot be a condemnation of church bake sales and raffles. I think it is something far deeper, and that means it is more insidious. I remember during my years serving as an executive assistant at the denominational headquarters for Metropolitan Community Churches. I was the assistant for Reverend Elder Donald Eastman, who was the treasurer for many years when he was a denominational executive. And one of the best, brilliant man, loved him, excellent mentor and teacher. He's now in retirement, but like so many clergy, can't quite entirely stay retired. But one of the things that I recall learning from him is we would frequently be asked in all kinds of different ways from local churches or persons in local churches, what do we get for our 15% to the denomination? At that time, it was 5% to a geographic district and 10% to the denomination. What do we get for our 10%? And what I learned from Donald Eastman was simply this: that is the wrong question to be asking. It is a fair question to ask what is done with what I give. That is a stewardship question that we should all rightly ask of our local churches, our local leadership, denominationally, the whole way up. What is done? But when we ask it with the framework, what do I get? That is the issue. You know, because our giving is often volunteerism, but many of us and all of us at some way or another give financially to this and other ministry organizations. And because we do that with money, whether it be electronically or physical money, we come to view it, consciously or unconsciously, as a financial transaction. We come to think of it unconsciously that I am purchasing a product or I am paying for a service being provided by somebody else. Why do we make God's house a marketplace? So if I've never said it this clearly, let me say it now. You are not an audience member, you are an actor. You are not a consumer, you are a creator. You are not a customer. You are a member of a community. And as a member of a community, you are part of a body. You and I and we all together are responsible for what is created by MCC Portland. Even if you don't ever have the chance to volunteer with the People's Pantry on a Tuesday, you are still part of making it happen when you contribute food, when you contribute finances, even when you contribute to the general fund, because that keeps the electricity running, that keeps the freezer going to give away food. You are part of making that happen with your financial gift. And whether you can carry a tune in a bucket or not, you are part of the success of our music ministry through your words of encouragement, through your identification and recruitment of others to participate in our music ministry. You and I and we are all a part of it. The ushers and greeters are, yes, trained and scheduled to welcome people, but they are not the only ones who are part of providing a warm and friendly and helpful welcome to one another. For probably 3 years now, when I have introduced the offering, I have used in some way or another the words, our offering is an act of worship. And I've hoped that the message implied is this is an act of worship, not a financial transaction. So the next time you hear those words, this is an act of worship, remember, it's not a financial transaction. You worship with the gift of your finances. So it makes me wonder, just like in the ancient temple, have you or I adopted attitudes and practices that conflict with the values we really want to profess? Have we internalized wrong values? If yes, Stop making God's house a marketplace. And if that weren't unsettling enough, the third thing that this overturns, that I would feel happy and blessed if Jesus showed up. We all like to imagine if Jesus walked in and sat down, he would grin with pride at you and me and how wonderfully we minister to one another, which we often do. But if I imagine that that is all that Jesus would have to say or do if he showed up in our community, I am living in a fool's paradise. If I think that if Jesus arrived, our table would not get rattled, that we might not feel a little bit of a sting, we are not really paying attention. We would far prefer to see Jesus turn over the tables of that grinning, mega-rich televangelist. That would be so satisfying, wouldn't it? We would love to see Jesus crack the whip at the system of silence that allows the abuse and exploitation of children in other religious institutions. Oh, wouldn't that make us feel self-righteous? It is far more satisfying to see Jesus unsettle and judge those people over there, or maybe even the person sitting next to me or across the room. Far more unsettling to realize that Jesus might have a word or two unfavorably about me, or about you, or about us. Maybe that is why this is a reading for the Lenten season. It's a reminder. It's the promise that just when we have got a little too comfortable, when we think it is all settled and sorted out, that our tables are perfectly set, that Jesus comes in and overturns that well-set table so we can remember what is really important. Please pray with me. God, we name and we claim that you are alive and active. We name it and claim it because it is a comfort, it is a guidance, and we recognize in humility that it might also be a corrective, that your spirit and your presence may unsettle us, may cause us pain, so that you can call us back to following you ever more faithfully. God, continue to guide and direct and form us to be your people. In your holy name we pray. Amen.